This is Dialogue on Teaching. I am Nancy Lynn Westfield, director of the Wabash Center, and of course, Dr. Paul Myrie is in the engineer's booth. It is my great pleasure to have in the studio today Dr. Mary Hess. Mary is professor of educational leadership at Luther Seminary in St. Paul, Minnesota. Mary is joining us just out of a doctoral seminar, so we are appreciative that you are here and know that you are spent, but glad you are up for this conversation nonetheless. Welcome, Mary.
Thank you.
So in this time of COVID, in this time of pandemic and social distancing, in this time when students are anxious and afraid, not just because of grades and expectations, but because of the changing social landscape, faculty are spent because of grades and because of the changing landscape. What matters right now?
That's a great question. And part of my answer is what matters right now is actually also what has mattered all along in good teaching, right? Being present to each other, being present to the questions that are emerging. I mean, I will admit that I have found the work of some of the folks who are thinking about trauma, people like Shelley Rambo and others, to be really useful. And one of the things that people who talk about trauma-informed teaching say are that you need, on the one hand, to focus on predictability, but also flexibility, right? And that you need to think not only about connection, but about empowerment. And so I know in my own teaching, as I've tried to think about what are the essential questions I'm trying to work on in courses with students, how can I make those questions come alive in the particular context we're in? You know, the other thing I'd say is that this whole pandemic, on the one hand, there's this recognition somehow that we are all in it together, that it's global, that we have this collective consciousness. And I want to both say, yeah, that's true. And I want to say, and it's so different for everybody. So, you know, in the midst of a class, you know, I have 72 students in one of my classes, and every single one of those students has a different challenge they're facing and trying to be in the class. And for some students, it really matters that the class happens, you know, at this time on this day for this amount of time. And for other students, it's really a pain that it's happening then because they've got kids at home that they're trying to homeschool and the dog is barking and they're worried about their mother. And yeah, so it's just, it's both a collective consciousness and it's not, I mean, or it's context collapse, I suppose.
And when you say predictability, do you mean that routinized know what to expect? Say more about
predictability. Well, I think it means something about, yeah, knowing what to expect and not changing things all the time, all at once, right? So I think it matters that I've said to my students, okay, we had the syllabus at the beginning of the semester. Obviously, that's not the situation we're in now. So I'm changing these things, mm-hmm. right? But I'm not going to keep changing them every week.
Yeah.
I'm going to say, here's what I'm hoping for. Here's how I intend to approach it. Here's why these assignments, like in one of my classes, so I teach in a seminary and I teach in the arts of leadership part of the seminary. And one of the classes I teach, students are in contextual placements. And they had learning agreements at the beginning of the semester with those contextual placements, but now they're pretty much not happening, because most of them were churches or nonprofits and they're all closed down. And they were supposed to write a case study based on that. And it's hard for them to even think through what's going on, let alone have enough distance to write a case study. So I said, look, here's the thing. This is a course on contextual learning. We are in the middle of a very pressing context. Mm-hmm. So let go of the concerns you had about, are you going to meet every goal of your learning agreement? And let's think about what you can learn in the middle of this. So it's predictable in the sense that we're still focused on the same kinds of questions. Mm-hmm. This is a contextual situation. What are we learning from context? And I'm not saying, and you have to hand in this case study by such and such a date. Mm-hmm. If you can do it, great. I promise to comment on it. And I know that you're learning, mm-hmm. even if you can't spit out 500 words about it right now. And I think that's why predictability and flexibility matter mm-hmm. so much together, that it's a shared mutual kind of thing.
So I think the predictability and the flexibility lend also to what you were talking about in terms of let the questions come alive in the context. Mm-hmm. Or the question, you know, so talk about the alive question, because for so many people, the questions are flat, right? Yeah. And not flattening questions.
No, and this is one of the interesting things to me about trying to do this work in the middle of a Christian seminary, because I think that if we can't talk about death, if we can't talk about finitude, if we can't talk about fear and uncertainty, where else are we going to be able to talk about it, right? I mean, Shelley Rambo has this great quote about how divine love is revealed at the moment at which it is most threatened, right? She's talking about Jesus's crucifixion. And I think this, if we cannot talk about and actually be present to the fear and the uncertainty and the grief that is not simply, I shouldn't say simple, but some of us will have grief right now because somebody we love is ill or has died. But a lot of us also, probably more of us, have what you might call anticipatory grief. Grief of what, I mean, I have a niece who's graduating from high school and she's not going to have her commencement ceremony and she's not going to have prom and who knows what's next, right? So being present to the grief that is in the context, being present to our fear and uncertainty, sometimes that means just breathing. Like right now, I spend a lot of time with classes just starting it with, okay, we're just going to breathe for 2 minutes, listen to your breath. Mm-hmm. And those, the questions that emerge from that are lively questions, even if they're hard. And they're questions that actually have lived in our context in a long time in lots of ways. And for some communities, even more pressing than for others. And we didn't always let them in. Now, hopefully, we're going to let them in.
Well, we didn't let them in, but they pressed their way in nonetheless, right? Yes. There's no way you can keep this cultural event, global event, shut out of the classroom, because the crises of society have always come in with the bodies of the learners, as mm-hmm. well as the professor. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That cannot be denied right mm-hmm. now, but the kind of pedagogy that you're describing takes a whole lot of courage. Where are people getting this courage from?
Oh yeah, that's a hard one. I don't know. I mean, I said to somebody the other day, you know, every once in a while I curl up on my bed in the afternoon and I just weep.
Yes.
You know, yes. I don't know. Mm. I mean, you know, I can say something about where prayer leads me. I can say something about how there are particular psalms that come to mind to me and songs that I've sung over the years. David Haas, who I know I love as a Catholic musician, not everybody likes his hymns, but he did this wonderful thing for Easter where he just played a bunch of his songs and had people sing and did it, you know, all on Zoom. And sometimes I just go back to those songs, because even if, you know, this is where you all at Wabash, I love the work you're doing around imagination and creativity, and because that's where some of that comes from, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So courage is not the absence of fear and anxiety, right? Courage right. is what you muster in the face of fear and anxiety.
Right.
So when there's something about inspiriting, breathing into, inspiring people to have courage. And it just so happens that our people are our students, right? Our right. learners who are looking to us to inspire them to courage and not to just heighten their fears or to, you know, say, yes, it is due on this date, no matter what. No, there is no flexibility.
Well, and I think even beyond that, I am in a seminary in the Upper Midwest, and there are some things about the Upper Midwest that, I mean, I grew up here in Wisconsin, so I grew up with some of this, but we're not big fans of conflict. Mm. We are not good at engaging conflict directly. And one of the things I had to move away from home to learn before I could come back is that actually conflict, difficult questions, even don't have to be conflict, but difficult questions are opportunities to learn. And so helping my students, trying to create spaces where my students are actually able to say, I don't know, and that's okay. I mean, I think enough of us as faculty don't actually, maybe that's where the courage for me comes in, is can I say, I don't know. And this is really hard.
Well, one of my mentors, Chuck Foster, mm-hmm. Oftentimes used the word grapple. Let us grapple together about this mm-hmm. issue. And I remember not liking the word grapple, Right. First of all, it was an old-fashioned word to me when, you know, I was with him in the classroom in my early to mid-20s. But it, part of what he was saying is part of coming to know is not knowing.
Right.
I didn't like that. That was
right. Well, right, because we're supposed to go to school to learn, right?
That's exactly
you're
right.
You're going to tell us what we're supposed to know.
You're going to tell us, and then we'll know, and then we'll go on. So not only is it too simplistic, but it's just not, it doesn't account for the messiness of humanness.
Right, and here we are in the middle of not only the messiness of humanness, but the messiness of a digital ecology that is spreading all sorts of stuff. Most of which, I mean, if you think about it, the ladder from data to information to knowledge to wisdom, mm-hmm. we're hardly even at the data rung on the ladder. And so all this stuff is out there, and how do you know how to sort through it? And we haven't done a very good job for a long time with helping people think about what I might call information literacy or digital literacy. We haven't helped people think about how do you judge the authority or authenticity of information that you're receiving, because there's so much out there coming from ostensibly authoritative sources, and a lot of it is really bad information or even manipulative and lying, right?
And dangerous information.
Yeah, yeah, dangerous. Yeah. So I mean, that's the. So how do we, you know, how do we stand up there as professors professing something mm-hmm. ostensibly because we have knowing, and then we say, I don't know. That's well, how right. does that help somebody else figure out, right?
That's right.
And that's the nub of what's challenging all of this.
So much of what I think I hear people talking about without this language is discovery learning. Mm-hmm. Because we're in such new terrain in society, even in our own classrooms, that it is pushing us to say, even if we could say before, but pushing us now to live out, what does it mean for teacher and learner to discover and learn together in a kind of mutuality? We say those words. This is the moment when we're either doing it or trying to figure out how to do it.
Right, and this is the moment where they can come alive, right? I mean, this is the moment in which so much of what some of us have been trying to say for a long time about how digital tools are not have to be, but can be a route for engagement and relationship and connection. Mm-hmm. We can hear stories from people from all over the world. We can engage. I think there's this piece you may have seen that's, you know, going around, spread a lot in social media, the letter from the virus. And it's a lovely little video that it's like in Portuguese or Spanish, I don't know, with English subtitles, but the point of it is this is the virus speaking, saying from the earth, basically from creation, we asked you to slow down. You didn't hear us when our lungs were burning. You didn't hear us when our, you know, when the water, the ice was melting. We need you to listen. And that a piece like that could be shared so widely is powerful. And I think it touches something, which is partly why it gets shared so widely. Mm-hmm. And there's the place where we are discovering, right? Mm-hmm. So instead of covering a field, mm-hmm. we're uncovering it.
I know, isn't that a terrible phrase? Let us cover the field.
Right. <What?
laughs> Or I have covered the field, right?
Yeah.
I
like, yeah, well, that's...
Dude, no, you haven't. No. So the... It sounds cliche to say that there are opportunities during this upheaval, but there are, right? That the piece of tape that is going around on Facebook and many of the pieces that do so resonate with a message of compassion and rethinking and reimagining mm-hmm. how we will no longer be so opposed to planet Earth, right? but actual citizens and participants.
Right. Actually inhabit the compassion we keep talking about.
We keep talking about, but then doing all these things that don't bear that out. It's a moment to do those kinds of things.
Yeah, and there's a lot of it happening. I mean, you know, that's the part of me that's the media scholar can't resist pointing out that in Minnesota, for instance, what the national media have covered about what's going on in Minnesota are things like the protests of the lockdown in front of the, you know, yes. the governor's residence, mm-hmm. rather than the long line of cars that were part of a protest to get people released from ICE detention. Wow. Right? Like that wasn't covered.
Wow.
And so there are all these stories of things people are doing for each other, of their awareness of what's happening, of the need to connect. I think human beings are wired actually to connect with each mm-hmm. other. Mm-hmm. And we have to teach ourselves not to, which is a terrible thing to do. Mm-hmm. So how do we now listen and find those places and the hope that lives in them, even in the midst of what is most hard? I mean, this is where I think there are communities in the United States, at least, who've lived with terrible, harsh, brutal, vicious injustice, and have found ways to hold on to life, to even live with joy in the middle of that. And that's something that some of us who, like myself, you know, white, middle class, professor, all that, we don't have those, we have not opened ourselves up in ways that would allow us to really let those stories in. And maybe this moment of existential fear, for a lot of people who haven't so much felt it before, mm-hmm. maybe it will draw us into better connection, right? Into deeper empathy, into more compassion. And that's where I think religious communities, and not just Christians, religious communities writ broadly, have resources. Mm-hmm. Right? We have ways to talk about, we have stories to tell, we have narratives that help us live with Holy Saturday, right? Live into the bleakness. We just got done in our church with part of the lectionary was the story of the disciples on the road to Emmaus. Mm-hmm. And it's hard not to think about, you know, people who are so torn up by what has happened. They have no understanding of what's happened and they have very little hope. And then they have this encounter because they were willing to offer hospitality to somebody. Mm-hmm. And that encounter transforms their whole understanding. So I hope our encounter with this pandemic may open us up, right? You know, it's Parker Palmer's thing about how when you stand in the tragic gap, your heart's going to be broken. The only question is it going to be broken open or broken into shards? And I'm really hoping we're being broken open.
So I love that quote, that Parker Palmer quote, and even the quote and the depth of the image, right? The depth of the mm-hmm. truth and wisdom in that. The populations that are best able to cope in these devastating moments because of the tragic and brutal heritages are the very populations that are being inflicted the most yes. pain on
yes.
during this moment.
Yes.
So while they are populations, while we, I'm a part of that population, have tools to offer, we're also devastated even more. I mean, you know what I mean?
It's just that's yes. And it's, I don't have a solution or words for that. All I have is some kind of hope that maybe those of us who have not, I mean, I know here in Minnesota, for instance, when the governor said in a week, we're going to have to shut down the schools. Mm-hmm. The first thing people said was, how are people going to be fed? Mm-hmm. Because our school system is such an important source of food, right? When the jails, when they're, we call them congregate living spaces now, I think it's so fascinating, right? So nursing homes and rehab centers and jails are congregate living. Okay. Mm-hmm. So when the virus is spreading there, people finally saying, wait a minute, this is not, you know, could we please, instead of believing the worst about somebody we don't know and the best about us, could we shift that around and believe the best of somebody we don't know and be open to perhaps the fact that maybe our behavior has led to the worst, right? I mean, the sort of...
Which if we could not even get that, but move toward that, that would be miraculous in and of itself, that that kind mm-hmm. of societal communal truth, that kind of revelation would be marvelous. I do think and hope that it also calls into question this moment, which I think it is, rethinking the fact that we put similar kinds of people under the same roof, and where the virus is pointing out, the spreading of the virus is pointing out all the places and the ways we should not house people and warehouse people, mm-hmm. which that map in and of itself is illuminating and calls into question, why do we warehouse all these people in this way?
Oh, amen. Well, why do we warehouse people? Why do we treat animals in our food supply this way? Why do we do, I mean, there's so many different interlocking things that we know and have known for a long time are wrong. Mm-hmm. And maybe now it's, I was talking to a surgeon almost a month ago now, and he was saying to me, yeah, this began as a rich people's epidemic. And I thought, well, that's an interesting comment. And he was saying, because travel, right? And the people who have the ability to travel globally and all the, and his thought was that in part, that's why also some people started responding so quickly to it. Because mm-hmm. there are all sorts of epidemics and things that happen that we have not responded to. Mm-hmm.
The HIV epidemic, people are like, those are just the gay boys. We don't care.
Yeah, that's actually, mm-hmm. that was my era of conscientization. I was an undergraduate when that was starting. So there's a part of me that also says, and this is just so huge. And so there are moments when all I can think about is what can I do in my class that is present to the students who are in that setting that I might create some room to think about this, because I don't seem to be able to have the kind of impact I'd like to have in these other places, but maybe this is the place I've been called to.
But I think also it reminds us of the power of teaching, the power of these spaces to help people, to help redeem the planet, to make a mark, to comfort people in a time of great anguish, right? So these classrooms are not benign or neutral spaces.
No, that's for sure. That is for sure. And, you know, so we have a niece living with us who had to leave the dorms at the university down the block because, you know, they're closing on the dorms. And so I've been listening to her talk about the ways in which different undergraduate faculty at her institution are treating students, right? Mm-hmm. And some of the faculty are very open to creating room and listening, and some of the faculty absolutely refuse. And she's getting a very clear sense of what helps her and what does not, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there are in the middle of this, there are maybe opportunity isn't the right word. We're being broken open in some ways mm-hmm. that may allow us to live more deeply into compassion, mm-hmm. that may allow us to learn and discover in deeper, more transformative ways. And there are also ways in which we are being broken into shards, and some of those shards are very dangerous.
Yeah. So Parker didn't tell us both might happen at the same time, right? That we might be broken open and broken in the shards. That's what you just said, that both might be happening at the same time. That's a little chilling in and of itself.
Yeah, but it's also the story of humanity, right? I mean, isn't that partly the, at least in some religious settings, it's why we even use language like sin or brokenness.
And redemption and healing.
And redemption, exactly, right? It's always the both, mm-hmm. at least
the both and.
In the tradition I grew up in, it's the both and. Mm-hmm. And we have to, I think about that piece Serene Jones wrote in the summer of 2016 before the election, when she talked about healing America's spiritual pain, and she talked about the necessity of living awareness of the brokennesses in our history mm-hmm. if we were also going to grasp the joy and the sense of diverse connection. It's both.
Not one hand pretending like there isn't another hand, right?
Right.
But you gotta do both.
We're all in the body together.
Yeah. And if we had forgotten that or didn't live that way, we have certainly been reminded of that in this moment. Mm-hmm. Dr. Mary Hess, your wisdom and your conversation is very refreshing, very delightful. I thank you. Good to be with you.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
And we're out. How's that, Paul?